91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with NPR Arts Desk reporter Netta Ulaby, whose radio and online stories cover the arts, cultural trends, and digital media. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Netta Ulaby is recognized for her profiles of breakout artists and behind-the-scenes tastemakers, as well as views of the political and economic realities of culture and media obsessions. She's become a fixture at NPR over the past 15 years. Ulaby was born in Lebanon, Jordan, and spent a childhood in Kansas and Michigan. She attended Bryn Mawr College and studied at Oxford and the University of Chicago. Stay tuned, Bonnie and I, with Netta Ulaby after NPR and regional news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, Wednesday edition.
And this hour, Joe and I visit with NPR Arts Desk reporter Netta Ulaby. We've heard and enjoyed her stories on art, music, TV, film, new media, and literature for some 15 years.
It's quite a challenge to keep up with the endless 21st century media trends, obsessions, and transitions. But her radio and online work is far-ranging, and Netta also very insightful.
Thank you.
Enjoy your work.
Thanks for such a generous introduction and for a welcome here.
And welcome. And we're so happy to have you. I guess I'd like to start with your background. You were born in Amman, Jordan. You grew up in the Midwest. Tell us just a little about
It was a very boring pedestrian background. My father's from Syria. He came to the United States to study engineering because in the Arab world, if you're middle class, as in much of the world, you're allowed to be three things if you're a guy, which is a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. My father wanted to be a physicist, but that was verboten, so off he went to Texas, of course, to study engineering, where he met my mother, an Irish Catholic working class girl who was desperate to get out of Texas. And off they went to Amman, Jordan, where my father was teaching. A war broke out right when I was born. My mother and I were evacuated when I was just a few days old. He had family in Syria and Lebanon. We got on a plane to Lebanon, and it was shot down when I was 3 days old. And my parents, who were both in their early 20s, just like babies at the time. I was really the baby.
But just you and your mom were on the plane.
Because my father was not an American citizen at that point. He has been for many years now, but he was not then. And so he wasn't allowed to be evacuated. And he stood in the airport and watched as the plane where his baby daughter and wife was shot down. Now, fortunately, we were just feet off the runway. I'm making it sound in some ways more dramatic than it was.
Well, yeah.
So we sat on the plane. We got on another plane after the mortar fire stopped, and off we went to Lebanon. And this was before cell phones. He had no idea
if you were even alive.
Yeah. And he ended up sneaking across the border a few weeks later, reuniting with my mother and his family there. Then they lived there for a while. War broke out. Then we moved to Paris very briefly, where living as an Arab man and a white woman was a little bit like living as a black man and a white woman in 1940s Alabama.
Right.
And after a certain point, my mother said, take any teaching job you can take in the United States. I don't care where it is.
Don't tell me you went from Paris to Lawrence, Kansas.
We went from Paris to Lawrence, Kansas. And you know what? Lawrence was amazing. I'm sure some of your listeners have been there or lived there. It's like Austin, but smaller.
So it's a neat city?
It's, you know, it's home of University of Kansas. It's undiscovered. When I lived there, William Burroughs was there also. He actually lived a few blocks away from me. It's a dynamic, interesting, and very cosmopolitan city, as university cities are. We lived there till I was 12.
Right.
Then we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
So did you always have a sparked interest in the arts?
Yeah, you know, both of my parents did not come from families where people took ballet lessons as little girls, for example, and it meant a lot to them. They were both the first people in their family to go to college, and they took incredible pride in giving us an arts education. I don't think they expected that my brother, sister, and I would all end up working in the arts in some capacity or another, which we did. My sister repairs violins. My brother got a PhD in ethnomusicology. And I work for the arts desk. But I was, my parents very much encouraged me to pursue an interest in the arts.
So before you were kidnapped by mm-hmm. radio, you were a managing editor at a newspaper in Chicago?
I was. Like a lot of people at NPR, I'm very proud to say I have a very checkered and unsavory background. And what I did was I worked at a newspaper in Topeka, Kansas, after I graduated from college. Then I went to grad school, thinking I was going to be an English professor. But the newspaper had gotten into my bloodstream. All I wanted to do was, well, this is what happened. I mean, to be honest, I'm a creature of instant gratification is what I learned. And I found I could spend months working on a paper that no one would read except for one person, and that I would get a grade and I wouldn't get paid. Or I could spend a day working on an article that thousands of people would read and I would get paid. And so being the person with the short attention span that I am, I thought, well, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to do what's easy and what pays me. And so I ended up being a film critic for the local gay and lesbian newspaper in Chicago, and ended up being the managing editor of that newspaper.
And did you do obits there too?
No. I started off doing obits. If your listeners probably don't know this, but I have the reputation of being the obits queen of NPR. I don't even know what to say about it. Here's the thing. People with these incredible backstories, these incredible accomplishments die. And NPR has traditionally not been a super well-resourced place. It's public radio. We don't have an obits desk. And when I started at NPR, and I started as a production assistant, my job was to get the coffee and to, log the transcripts and to sharpen the pencils, do whatever needed to be, whatever needed doing. And when someone famous would die, the entire place would go bananas because who had the time to put together obits in advance? So
or have a morgue.
Morgue, exactly, that as they're called. And so on my free time, I would sit around and I would do advance obits. And I kind of got a reputation for being the person who, when somebody would die, would say, oh, look, the obit's done. And that, to be honest, really helped me get my job as a reporter for the NPR Arts Desk. It did.
I saw this thing that your obit for Elliot Smith set a record for downloads on NPR.
That was a long time ago. And that one was not, thankfully, an advance obit. I mean, he was so young when he died. And I just had a couple of hours to put that together. And Elliot Smith, for a lot of, like a lot of people who listen to his music, he meant a great deal to me. Mm-hmm. And that obit just, I got to tell you, poured straight out of my heart muscles. I can barely remember doing that obit, but that was possibly the most heartfelt obit I've ever done, and I've done a lot of them. I have to confess to you that I sometimes end up doing obits for people I've never heard of, and sometimes I think, I've never heard of this person. Why do I need to do this obit? And by the end of the day, I am deeply in love with that person.
Isn't that something? So by actually studying their lives, you get that close to them.
And that's the thing about obits. People say, oh, that must be really depressing. And it's the opposite of depressing. The Elliot Smiths aside, these are people who've had incredible lives. And you're telling the story of a life. You're not telling the story of death.
Netta, how does the public radio audience, in your opinion, differ from the mainstream? And how does that affect your approach, if it does?
Well, they're very old.
Well, now.
At least in this room.
How are they different? Well, not to flatter the people who are listening right now, but I think we have an incredibly curious, interested, intelligent audience, people who care about the world.
Good demographics.
The best, although they are very persnickety. They're very demanding, but I appreciate that about our audience. If they hear something they don't like, whether it be Kim Kardashian on Wait, Wait, or the inflection of an announcer's voice, they will let you know.
Right.
And their opinion counts. And that's the other difference, is I think we listen and we really care.
Did you ever consider commercial radio?
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, NPR was just, and public radio, when you grew up in a place like Lawrence, or especially a place like Lawrence, you're very far from a city, from a big city. There's Kansas City, but the thing that brings you there is public radio. And my parents clung to their radio station. I mean, they had their arms around it, listening all the time.
So is that why you first, what drew you to radio?
It seemed unattainable. I never even imagined that I would end up on public radio. All I wanted to do was tell interesting stories and meet interesting people. And I ended up on working for NPR as a total fluke. But I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess so. So I wanted to ask you, this is something I was talking with to a colleague this morning about the Taylor Swift Apple thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just give us a little background about that and your thoughts on her challenging, you know, actually a major corporation, and the fact that a major corporation is trying to not pay artists for their work.
I haven't covered that story, so I can't go very deeply into it. I mean, I've just sort of skated over it, but I did cover the music industry for a while. And I mean, I think it's really fascinating. I'm really impressed, to be honest, by Taylor Swift's ability to stand up to Apple and to hold it accountable for not paying artists. I think that's a really big deal. I think this is a watershed moment.
Right.
And I'm fascinated to see what happens next.
Now, evidently, he tells me this is the second time she's challenged the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and to see a young woman artist have those kind of
scruples?
Yes. I'm really blown away. I'm really blown away by Taylor Swift's by the stand that she's taking on behalf of other artists in particular.
Right, because clearly it's not a money issue for her.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
We're speaking with Netta Ulaby, and you know her from NPR. She's at the Arts Desk. She has been for 15 years on NPR. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll invite you to join in the conversation. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Netta Ulaby. And Netta, I was wondering, in your 15 years at the NPR Arts Desk, what's changed in the way you've covered media, especially with such the divergence of digital sources and social media?
Oh, my mind is boggling as I go back to when I first started working at NPR, and I learned I was the very last generation of NPR reporters who cut tape with razor blades.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you guys probably remember those days. And I don't know about you, but I'm nostalgic for it. And I'm so grateful.
That grease pencil and the jockeying on the real machine.
I had an editor who was legally blind. And I don't know how you could do that now, but she felt her way around her cubicles. She cut tape with the razor blade, and she did it so quickly. It was amazing. And I remember, you know, you'd walk back past people's desks, and there'd be like huge, you know, like waterfalls of tape taped to their cubicles. And I remember seeing like little teeny tiny snippets, mm-hmm. and I would ask, "What are those?" And people would say, "Well, those are breaths." And I found that so poignant that there were these little just. These inhalations.
Don't put that tape near the bulky racer.
Oh, and there were disasters then too, as there are now. I mean, digital is not an improvement when it comes to losing stuff. That's for sure. But it's gone through so many changes, hasn't it? There was a period, and this is maybe a little bit funny, where I always like to have young people on the air. And I would look for young people on social media, and there was a period where they were amazingly easy to find because nobody was worried. And here I was, this grown-up, contacting teenagers out of the blue, saying, "Hey, do you want to talk about whoever the Taylor Swift was of, you know, 2004, like Britney Spears or whoever?"
To get a barometer.
And now there's no way. It would be very difficult to, thank goodness, to approach teenager.
It's too bad, but...
Yeah, I mean, it also helped me find teenagers who were way out of my, you know, people who were way out of, you know, who lived in different parts of the world, who were from different class backgrounds, to represent, you know, a variety of voices at NPR. I mean, too often, I think people in media generally will say, "Oh, I'll talk to my friend's kids," my kids' friends.
Right, right.
And that's not good journalism. So, so stalking teenagers online, that's changed. What else has changed? Oh, well, now, of course, we have to Instagram and tweet and Facebook, you know, our stories. But I like that. You know, do you guys have to do that here? Is social media part of what
Well,
you do?
We have Paul Leary is our online producer, and he does do a lot of, you know, the posting on Facebook and the tweeting. And
he's doing it as we speak.
Yeah, I'm sure he is.
And some people are geniuses at it. I mean, if your listeners are following Ari Shapiro, I don't know how that guy sleeps.
Yeah, I mean, he's always on it.
He's always on it when he's not performing with Pink Martini or you know, breaking some international news story.
But you enjoy it?
Oh, I do. It's a chance to talk to all different kinds of people, and it's a chance, you know, we tell stories. I think
in 140 words,
in haikus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And how else has it changed it? What do you think? Are there any negative aspects? What stands out?
I mean, I think attention spans have changed. I mean, the fact that the three of us can talk now for uninterrupted for almost an hour. When I first started
at eye contact.
And make eye contact, exactly. When I started at NPR, it was the average. I'm extrapolating a little bit here, but the stories that I worked on tended to be 6 or 7 minutes long. Now the stories that I work on tend to be 3.5 or 4 minutes long. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, you go back and listen to some of those stories, and they go on and on and on and on. But the way we listen has changed, and the expectations of how you tell a story has changed, too.
And the fact that we're listening often on mobile devices now. We're not sitting in front of a radio and don't have the time, really, to do that.
Yeah, and there's so many things competing for our attention, and we don't even watch our TV on TVs anymore. You know, we often don't listen to our radio on radios anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, to touch on the process of how you get a piece on the air and how you go about doing that.
And how you choose.
Yeah. Well, I come up with probably half of my pieces, and then the other, there's a quarter that are probably assigned by my editors and a quarter assigned by the shows. You know, some of them are reactive, like the Obits. My favorite part, and I feel like if I was a more pure radio reporter, my favorite part would be listening to the tape, playing with the tape. My favorite part is actually setting stuff up. It's finding the people, talking to the people, doing the pre-interview, sort of figuring out what a sense of the story is going to be. I find the people, I set them up. It's very important to us not to have phone tape with feature pieces in particular. Coaxing people into studios takes up more of my job than a lot of people would probably anticipate.
So you're actually producing all of these as you go.
I do a lot of my own producing, and that's partly because I came up as a producer. I didn't, you know, even though I did come from print, I started at the bottom and worked my way up. So I can do it, frankly, pretty quickly. I know what I have in mind, and that's what I like to do, and I don't like to farm out my work to you know, some 21-year-old who's serving a bunch of reporters. Who, and ours, by the way, does it incredibly well. He's a brilliant producer. I get the people into the studios. I interview them. I listen to the tape. I pull the pieces of tape. And then my colleague, Lynn Neary, told me how to do a story from there. And this is what I really had to learn how to do that was that I didn't expect, is you have to cede control. When you're a newspaper reporter, you can kind of just tell the story you want to tell the story. In radio, the voices are telling the story. Right. And if somebody, you know, I've got this white cup in front of me, and if I need somebody to say, I've got a white cup, then they don't always say it. Sometimes they'll be like, I've got a white cup, but I've got this really great white piece of paper. And you got to go with the piece of tape where they sound excited and engaged. And sometimes that takes your story in ways that you didn't really expect. And the person's voice tells truths that you can't control. And to let those truths be part of the story is a major part, or was for me, of learning how to be a radio reporter.
Does that affect your interview style versus print interviews?
Sure.
Of trying to kind of coach them into saying what would be...
Well, do you have to coach them?
With a complete sentence or something?
A little bit. But to be honest, if someone's getting all excited about the white piece of paper, then I pivot.
I'm all excited about the fact that your cup is empty.
I know.
I bet you are too.
You know, it can take your inner, rather than try to force people to say what I want them to say, I think it's more interesting to hear, to go with where they're going, you know, and I can always say what I want to say in copy. But who knows, you know, you can go down some pretty interesting paths when you hear people start talking about the white piece of paper.
Have you ever been working on a piece and you just thought, this isn't going to work?
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah.
A lot?
Or sometimes it's not going to be as long as I thought it was going to be, or sometimes it's going to go in a different direction. But yeah, I've killed pieces. I mean, I think I would be irresponsible if I didn't kill pieces.
And have you ever killed an assignment? I mean, if your editor gives you something that, you know, you're required to do? Are you allowed? Do you have jurisdiction? Or
I would never kill a piece on my own, but I would definitely go to my editor and say, look, you know, this isn't working. I can't find the people I need. The angle that we thought was such a good idea isn't really coming through. And I, you know, of course, in a concrete example isn't coming to mind, but I felt like I did that fairly recently, that I pitched an idea that I thought was a really good idea. I started doing some follow-up on it, and then I went back to my editor and I said, look, I'm really sorry. It's not going to work.
And how often do you have to produce pieces?
You know, there's sort of an expectation of one a week or so. Mm-hmm. The news spots, which are just, you know, the newscast, little 30 to 45-second stuff that, you know, you heard right before the show started.
Right, right. So do you have any, is there any question you've ever regretted asking or not asking?
Oh, you know, I mean, I was doing a piece about the earthquake in Haiti, and it was about fundraising. And it had something to do with, there was a musician who was involved in fundraising efforts, and the question of where the money was going was looking increasingly shady. And so I was asked to do a piece about that. And I talked to a guy who ran a relief effort in Haiti, and the money was supposed to go to him. And I was very intent on doing the story. And at some point I asked him a question and he just started crying. Mm. And I realized that I'd been in my head about the story, and I wasn't thinking like a human being. And that was for me one of the low points of my entire career.
It's the old story of a young journalist covering a fire in the city. The owner is out in front, and the journalist goes up there and says, "Was there anything of value in your house?"
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oops.
Yeah, I don't think it ever got worse than that.
Do you think that artists, you deal so much with artists, do you think artists have to be entrepreneurs in 2015?
I don't know. I would hate to say artists have to be anything.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, the last thing I want to do is force artists to do anything. But that said, Bonnie, you know, I feel like so many of my pieces, you know, Joe asked what's changed, and I feel like so many of my pieces are about how artists can empower themselves as business people, given all the tools that artists have right now, where they can promote their stuff and get themselves out there. It can be very confusing and very difficult, and it's been very interesting being here, learning about the kind of efforts that are happening in Southern Florida to help artists get that kind of training. You know, I did a piece really recently about how artists can sell their work online, and it's a staggeringly big world, and it's not a very well organized one.
So, I mean, so many artists though are loath to have to be in that position. You know, but it's almost like the times are requiring, because you don't have agents anymore, or mm-hmm. things have changed so much.
Yeah, and I think the cultural values have changed to a certain extent, too. You know, there was a period when, you know, part of being an artist meant turning your back on the shallow, crass,
yes.
materialist, commercial world. And now we live in the world of Taylor Swift, where part of being an artist can be, I don't think it's the only vision of being an artist, but it's also being a savvy businesswoman.
Uh-huh.
And God bless. And also, truth be told, the successful artists have always been savvy business people. You know, a lot of times they've pretended like they haven't been. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I also don't think there's anything wrong with turning your back, rejecting commercial culture.
Materialism.
I want people to stand up for those artists. As long as there's room for a multiplicity of ways to approach art, we're in good shape.
If you'd like to speak to Netta Ulibi, you're welcome to join in the conversation. Our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. I'm sure you have, but I'm just thinking, if you want to give an example, have you ever had to watch a performance or see an exhibit that actually you just didn't want to have to report on, but you did have to report on?
Yeah, I have. And usually in that case, it wasn't, you know, I'm not a critic. You know, it's not my job to say whether something is good or bad. The reason why I was at the performance or at whatever was because it represented something interesting that was happening.
Right.
That said, I have, and I don't want to give an example because I don't want to call out people who really were doing their best to do good work, but absolutely. But it's, and I'll tell you, very recently, I actually did a profile of a cultural thing.
Yes.
And I was really excited about it, and I witnessed it, and I thought, oh, you know what, this is not as good as I had hoped. And then the trick is to find out what's interesting about it.
So you can still report on it.
And to find out what our listeners are going to find interesting about it. You know, so much of what we all do is cultural.
What kind of responses do you get? What's typical? Or is there typical?
Oh, I don't know. What kind of responses?
Emails are so quick sometimes if they're critical or favorable or so exuberant.
It's hard to tell. I mean, you know, it's hard to tell. The people who comment on media websites tend not to necessarily be representative. They're often people who have an axe to grind about something.
Right. As
not always, but those people often drown out, the other voices. I find my most interesting critics and fans generally on Twitter, and they often say, you know, you left this out, or I liked this part, or both of those things, or I hate your voice, or you know, whatever. And hey, great. And that's actually a chance where we can talk to each other.
Again, our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. We do need to take a short break, but we'd love to hear from you. We're speaking with Netta Ulaby from the Arts Desk at NPR. Stay with us.
And 35 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we continue our discussion with Netta Ulaby. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Email, that's radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Tell me, consider that you cover media so much. How about the effect of the myriad of video streamers and affecting the landscape and our traditional view of television?
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, Joe. I'm actually working on a piece right now about how YouTube stars are gravitating to other video platforms, which in some ways doesn't sound like an interesting story. Like, I'm already sort of going to sleep just hearing that. But you think about how YouTube has completely dominated the online video world for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And people, as you know, many of your listeners probably know, make millions of dollars doing things like playing video games on YouTube. I mean, I cannot imagine sitting and watching a kid play Minecraft for hours, but apparently that's what your grandchildren are doing. And there's this, the ecosystem, the entire video ecosystem is going to completely change. And a lot of it's going to happen this year. I'm fascinated by that. And you think about, I was just looking at these statistics, that millennials are watching something like an hour less of television every year. Now, it's not like they're not sitting in front of screens. We know that.
And they're trying so hard on TV, though, with all these shows that they're bringing on. I wanted to ask you about Colbert. What do you think it's going to be like for him to not be in a character? I'm assuming he's not going to be in a character.
Yeah, I think everyone who has enjoyed his show, and I definitely count myself among those people, is waiting with bated breath. And, you know, that entire lineup is going to be fascinating, right? Jon Stewart leaving, Colbert taking over this completely different, you know, taking on a new persona.
Right,
I'm sure
right.
he's going to inhabit it brilliantly. Samantha Bee getting a show, which I'm super excited about. You know, it's going to be late night television. Political television is going to be, I think it's only going to get more fun. I really do. Although I think we're all going to miss Jon Stewart a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
So do you know of anyone up and coming now?
Up and coming. Well, I think, you know, we're all very curious about Trevor Noah, the guy who's taking over for Jon Stewart. I mean, that was a little bit of an inauspicious beginning. Inauspicious. And but I don't think that Stewart would have picked him if he didn't have an incredible amount of potential to offer. So that's going to be fascinating to watch him. Samantha Bee is a bit of a known quantity, but she's someone who I'm excited to see what happens with her new show.
I kind of was looking just the other day at one of your reports, And I found it, I don't know what the word really is for this, after the horror that just took place in Charleston. Mm-hmm. Then I see that this little teeny paper, the Charleston Post-Gazette, that's in South Carolina, won the Pulitzer Prize for public service.
Right, earlier this year.
Reporting?
It was about a domestic abuse. And it was quite something, I got to tell you. Pretty much every year, I cover the Pulitzer Prize winners. They announce it at 3. I have a piece on an hour and a half later. And one of the great joys of my job every year is calling the little papers that win the Pulitzer Prizes and saying, oh my gosh, tell me about what you just did. And that was the example this year. I mean, I'm getting chills thinking about it. What they did was they found out that South Carolina had a disproportionately large number of men murdering women in their lives. Yeah. And so they did an incredible, thorough, multi-month-long investigation into what was happening with domestic violence culture in their state. And here's this little tiny paper that pulled 4 reporters off their regular beats and dedicated them to looking into the history, into police reports, into what kind of options were available for battered women. And I haven't read the entire report myself, but I've read a lot of it. And if this is something that is interesting to your listeners, it's fascinating. It's as good as a New Yorker story.
I think you said, yeah, it is. And I think a couple of the figures they gave were that a woman was murdered every 12 days. Mm. And that there was an animal shelter in every county,
but not a
domestic shelter for women.
Yes.
For battered women.
Yeah, I mean, this is why journalism matters.
Yeah,
Netta, what do you read for pleasure?
Oh, I don't know. To be honest, Joe,
can you make time?
I read for pleasure on the plane over here. It's a real guilty pleasure. I read the new Stephen King novel. That was a super guilty pleasure. But a lot of the work I do, it's so much fun. I feel like all of the work that I do, all of the reading I do is for pleasure, even if it's for work. I'm in a book club. Our last book that we read was H is for Hawk, not a book that I thought I would be excited about reading.
Oh, God. I read about that in The New Yorker. I haven't read the book yet. Well, there's very little time to read here, too.
Yes.
But that just sounds so fascinating.
That was my last pleasure read before the Stephen King, and I can't recommend it more highly. I didn't think I would connect necessarily to a book about a British woman who'd lost her father, who was training hawks, and I couldn't put it down. It's so good.
And the one I just ordered yesterday, I think it's a tough book, is the one that won the Pulitzer this year, Door. Anthony
Yeah, I've
Dork.
Read that. All the Light You Cannot See.
All the Light You Cannot
See. It's not that tough. It's a bit of a fairy tale. The one that I'm going to read now that I've got Stephen King out of my system is the Mersault Investigation.
Oh, okay.
By the Algerian writer who takes Camus' The Stranger as his starting
Mersault.
Point.
Mersault, yeah.
That one I'm reading on the plane back.
Okay, that's...
Let's take a quick call. We've got Mickey in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. I was wondering, when I was a little kid, like 10 to 13, we used to be on the radio every Saturday. There's a little troop of us, about 8 or 10 kids. And I was just curious. We had so much fun doing it, doing little plays, little stories, using different accents. And I just wondered if there's anything like that that's happening these days.
Were you actually on the radio? You were broadcast?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Certainly on the national level, I would say no. But this is what's really cool. I mean, now what you and your kids, your friends were doing as kids, that's what kids are doing on YouTube. You know, kids are creating videos and they're putting on little shows and they're putting them on YouTube. And, there's, again, privacy issues that I think, parents need to be concerned about. But I don't know if radio is a space where people
Decades
are doing
ago,
that.
Decades ago, public radio tried to do that with the Earplay series, and they had Star Wars, the radio version.
That.
But it just never really clicked.
Can I suggest one thing, though, Mickey, which is I recently learned that the Library of Congress will take people's home recordings. And if you guys still have those, I would urge you to make a copy and send it to the Library of Congress to have so that they can archive this as part of the American experience.
That's amazing. I have a friend that was a curator at the Library of Congress. Yeah, that's a fantastic idea.
Okay.
I mean, you can also do it now, Mickey, just using GarageBand on a Mac,
right? Yeah.
Do a little radio thing and, I guess, post it online or post it, I guess, on YouTube.
If you could do that, that would be, I'd want to listen to the channel of this myself.
Well, I'll keep you posted.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Thank you.
So why don't we get to tonight before we take our break, or do we want to take our break now?
Whatever you'd like to do.
Well, let's talk about tonight.
What's happening tonight?
Oh, I don't know. What is happening tonight? Why don't we ask Jay Abade what's happening tonight? Jay is the president and CEO of ArtServe. And welcome to Topical Currents.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you. Tell us about ArtServe first.
Well, ArtServe is a nonprofit organization that is here to support artists in our community and really provide them a safety net and the skills that they need to be successful, thriving artists doing what they do best, which is practicing their profession in the arts. And we are delighted tonight to be having Netta Ulbi do a presentation at ArtServe, which is going to be part of a closing reception for a very important exhibit we're doing called DBA, Retrospective, Doing Business as Artist Entrepreneurs.
So tell us about that exhibit.
Okay, I'd love to. So the DBA Retrospective is really a celebration of and an outgrowth of one of the professional development workshops that we do at ArtServe. And this particular one was in association with the Artist as Entrepreneur Institute, which we present every year in partnership with the Broward Cultural Division. And it's almost like a mini MBA for artists. It's an intensive four-week course, and it gives them all the business skills that they need. If you think about it, Bonnie, it's so important because artists rarely study business. They study music, art, you know, dance, right, film. So they, all of a sudden, they're trying to run a dance company, and they really don't have the business acumen to do it, or they're trying to even manage their either business sales. So a group of people had gone through this institute year after year, and there was a group of three women that were so motivated. They were all visual artists, and they were so motivated by what they learned several years ago that they decided to put all their skills to work and mount their own exhibition. And so they went out, they secured funding, they secured a venue, they got a collective of artists together, they presented their exhibit, and it was very successful. And the next year, they mentored the next group of people, graduates from the Artist as Entrepreneur Institute, and here we are 7 years later, and they are so busy and so successful now that they really said that they were sort of struggling with being able to, you know, mentor. And we brainstormed some ideas, and we said, why don't we do a retrospective of the work? Because now over 70 people have gone through the program, and had their careers have taken off, and there's some wonderful, wonderful success stories. So tonight is the closing reception for this wonderful exhibition, and we are so thrilled to have Netta Ulbi speak at the reception and to speak on some topics that are really resonate with a lot of the people attending tonight.
Now, Netta will be there tonight, and also I believe someone named Bonnie Berman might be there tonight too.
That is absolutely
well, yes,
true.
Yes.
We are.
I'll just be
introducing. I want to go see her.
Yeah, right. I'll just be introducing Netta. Well, and. Is there still room available for people to come?
Absolutely. We encourage people to come out and to meet both Bonnie and Netta, because, you know, both people are such a part of our lives. We feel like we know you. You're in our homes, our cars, everywhere we go. And the reception opens tonight at 6 p.m. And then Netta will be introduced by Bonnie Berman, will be starting at 7 p.m. So we do encourage people to come out to ArtServe. It's in Fort Lauderdale. It's easy to find. We have lots of parking, and we look forward to seeing everybody. And the exhibition is going to be up until through Friday of this week. So if people are not able to come and see it, they can come do so anytime in the next few days and come and see and purchase some art.
And do people need to reserve seats at artserve.org?
They can reserve.
Or can they just come?
Yes, they can. We prefer the seats. I actually don't know if they've stopped the online reservations, but again, you know, we encourage everybody to come in. We're turning nobody away tonight.
Okay, and the address is?
1350 East Sunrise Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale. And you can also get all the details at artserve.org.
Okay, it's Topical Currents.
How about a break now?
Let's take a break now. We're speaking with Netta Ulbi from NPR and Jay Abade from ArtServe, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Netta Ulbi. And we're taking calls at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Email, Bonnie has those, radio@wlrn.org. Netta, with such a torrent of things to cover with all the various media, how do you know what's important and what to cover?
You know, we speak to a national audience at NPR. So what is always foremost on my brain is what is going to interest somebody in Texas, in Kansas, in Kentucky, in Maine.
Or Peoria.
Peoria, right. What is of interest to a national audience? I think NPR, based in Washington, occasionally falls into the trap of focusing overly on what's happening in the Mid-Atlantic Beltway kind of area. And it's actually one of my huge overriding ambitions to make sure that we cover the arts nationally, which doesn't mean that we cover, you know, every ballet company across the country, but we look at the national trends. And when we talk to people outside of Washington and outside of the big cities and learn from them about what they're doing to innovate in terms of the art world.
I wanted to ask you about that plastinated body controversy.
Yeah.
So whatever happened with that?
I think those are cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you like it?
Well, you know, I was fascinated the first time I went to a plastinated body exhibition, and I went on the recommendation of one of my best friends who's a doctor. And she said, you will not believe what has, she loved it. She said, what? And, you know, if your listeners have been to Body Worlds in particular, that is, it's absolutely astonishingly beautiful. So I walk in, and the first thing I see is this placard hanging over the door that says every body in this exhibition has been ethically approved. I'm not getting the language right, but it's along those lines, of the Institute of Plastination. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. What's the Institute of Plastination? That became the basis of a pretty intense investigative story in which I learned that the Institute of Plastination is run by Body Worlds, and in short, the people who were giving the ethical okay to the bodies were the people who were running the show, and there's more to it than that. But I learned about this incredible world of displaying and exhibiting bodies, and I actually ended up talking to one of my main voices for the piece was a guy in Southern Florida. Dr. Lynn Romrell, who's a University of Florida grad. He used to run the anatomical board here in the state of Florida. And he had really interesting things to say about the body exhibitions. There's a knockoff show called Bodies, the Exhibition.
Right.
And he wanted to close down the one in Tampa because that one was pretty much straightforward about saying they had no way of knowing whether or not the bodies were ethically obtained.
I mean, that they could have been prisoners or they could have been...
Right. Many of these bodies came
homeless
from...
Homeless people.
Right.
Or,
right. Many of the bodies come from Chinese medical schools. They could be, in a worst-case scenario, the bodies of executed political prisoners.
Right.
But really what it comes down to is the ethics of the consumers. Asking yourself, do I want to support an organization, you know, a show where what I might be seeing is something like this. And I got to tell you, there was stuff that I just couldn't even put in the radio piece because it would gross people out too much.
Really?
There was another knockoff show that was in San Francisco, which has, as you know, a very large Asian community. People insisted on it getting shut down, partly because of the ethics of it and also because the bodies were so improperly preserved, they were dripping.
Oh.
It's pretty awful, right? Now, this is a very long and complicated story. It still lives online. And, you know, things have changed a lot with Body World. My guess, this is just an educated guess, at this point, enough people have donated their bodies to the exhibition that they probably don't need to rely on stray corpses.
Right.
That said, people should know that if you do donate your body to one of these shows, there's no guarantee that you're going to be exhibited in some kind of lovely post-death narcissistic way. It could be that your body will be plastinated and sold to a medical school.
Right.
Once it,
and do you just want to explain for our listeners that don't know what the plastinating?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a process by which the fluids in the body are removed and replaced with a kind of raisin. So they look. I think I said in the piece they look like petrified prosciutto, and it's gorgeous. I mean, it is a wondrous thing. I mean, it is not a bad thing in and of itself to have plastinated bodies or to have them on display or to learn more about the miracle of our bodies through this process. Mm-hmm. I think for everybody involved that I spoke to, the only issue was where did these bodies come from?
Right.
Or were they ethically obtained?
did they give consent for their bodies to be displayed?
Now, we have a lot of students here at the station in summer internships. What kind of advice would you give to someone who would like to do what you do or similar?
Well, you know, as I said a little bit earlier, when I started at NPR, I had run my own newspaper. I didn't own the newspaper, but I was the editor of it. And when I got to NPR, my job was literally getting people's coffee. And I think to have a good attitude about starting at the bottom is huge. Be willing to do the work that no one else wants to do, like
Ovitz. If you were in print, obviously, you would think writing would be the start.
Sure. Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, what I tell people often now is that being a journalist is a little bit like being an actor has always been. You've got to be absolutely vocational about it. It's got to be the kind of thing where you can't really see yourself doing anything but, and even if people won't let you do it, you're going to do it anyway. Mm. Even if you don't get a job at the newsroom you want, you're still going to write stories. And you're going to fill in wherever you're needed, covering whatever anyone tells you to. I mean, if I had started at NPR on the science desk, I would probably be a science reporter right now. That's, you take your opportunities where you find them and not where you want them.
Right, right.
So be versatile.
Absolutely.
And be open.
Be open, exactly. Yeah.
Let's take a quick phone call. West Palm Beach listener, this is Weber. Hi there.
Nigel, thank you. I have caught the program a little late. But I was excited to hear that you have one of my favorite announcers on the air. I have been listening to her for a long time. I have not heard much of her, but I tell you, I believe she has one of the most golden voice that one can listen to. And by the way, Bonnie Berman, if I have to choose between both, I'm not sure which one, but I tell you, they are two great ladies, and I'm happy to hear her on this local level. Now, is it my understanding that you are in Meadow, that is for you, that you are in Outer Years of Community Service?
First of all, can I say that you're one of my new favorite listeners?
That's right.
Possibly
mine too.
My favorite listener.
Mine too.
We now have a fan club here. Yeah. Community service. No, my background is, I have done a great deal of community service over the course of my life. I was I volunteered at a school for kids who were dropouts and who'd been kicked out of their regular public school. I did that for years. That was incredibly important to me. Right now, I'm very, I feel very badly saying so, but my job is so incredibly demanding that I'm not carving out the kind of room for community service that, frankly, I think every responsible civil adult should.
Yeah, sometimes we just don't have the time. Well, thank you so much for calling, and glad to know you're out there. We've been speaking with Netta Ulaby. She's an NPR reporter covering arts, cultural trends, digital media for NPR's Arts Desk, and we thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you tonight.
With more information about tonight.
And yes, we will. Jay Abadi is the president and CEO of ArtServe. That's artserve.org. And again, tonight at?
Tonight, the reception starts at 6 p.m. Come here, Bonnie and Netta, at 7 p.m., and we hope everybody comes out.
1350 East Sunrise Boulevard.
Thank you very much.
Netta Ulaby, pleasure to meet you. Pleasure to have you on the program.
Yeah, thank really. You. And thank you so much for everyone for listening.
Our pleasure. And again, thank you for listening. Today's program was produced by Polly Landis with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Additional assistance from lead producer Richard Ives. And of course, we always have free audio archives and downloads easily accessed at our website, wlrn.org. And more information, links, photos, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like for your friends. Tomorrow's program begins with regular contributor Dan Ricker, publisher of the Independent Watchdog Report. We'll discuss South Florida politics and government. And of course, it's Thursday tomorrow. That's Food and Dining with chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer and our wine guy, Fred Tasker. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.